Buglers, we are live from Leicester Square Theatre on the 16th of September with Chris Addison and Alice Fraser. It might be our only London date of the year, so get your tickets now. Oh, get them at thebuglepodcast.com. That bit's important.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This is a podcast from The Bugle.
Hello, welcome to Catharsis. I'm Tiff Stevenson, full-time comedian, part-time, massively unqualified therapist. I cannot stress enough how much I'm not qualified in any kind of therapeutic sense. Just for this podcast, every week I bring on a guest and I talk to them about their old wounds, petty gripes, unpopular opinions, and we dive into a historical beef in an attempt to see if we can provide some insight or indeed catharsis. You can sweat the small stuff with me. Before I introduce my guest, I like to get into something of my own. I received an email from the GP this week, and it was concerning binge drinking over the coronation weekend. Enjoy the ascension of your unelected monarch safely, guys. It was very concerned that I didn't drink too much, referenced how people in the UK like to drink. Binge culture is a phrase that's been thrown around for years, and it's always confused me, the term binge culture. It suggests that we're down in shots of Dickens, having a huge night on the classics and throwing up hours of Plato and Homer. Ugh, the Iliad's coming up again. Oh, she's left a couple of sonnets in the bathroom. What I will say is you don't have to worry about me and the binge drinking because I'm in my 40s now. It's not a concern anymore. Every hangover in your 40s is Sisyphean, by which I mean by the time you push that rock to the top of the hill, it's time to get pissed again. I can't handle it like I used to. And that person laughing at dealing with hangovers is my guest this week. I'm very excited to welcome to the podcast award-winning author, King of Tartan Noir. I've read many of his books. Some of them are on the shelf behind me. It's the fantastic Christopher Brookmeyer.
Hello. Hello. Just thinking of the Sisyphus there, the myth of Sisyphus. My son did philosophy and he said that the kind of sting in the whole Sisyphus myth is that it makes a different sense if you realise Sisyphus loves his job. You know, and I think if you apply that to hangovers, there's a whole new meaning to that too.
Yeah, and there's part of me that really loves it. I can't say there's a single part of me that enjoys the... I feel like I deserve it. That's the one thing. I do remember once they wouldn't let me on the Eurostar coming back from Paris when I'd been doing shows. And I was so I'd been throwing up a lot and I turned up green. And the guy behind the desk said to me, is it contagious? and I said, what? And he went, what do you have? Is it contagious? And I had to go, no, I did this to myself. Which I think is the worst part. So maybe, yes, maybe there is an enjoyment in the penance because we feel like we deserve it in some small way, I guess.
I was thinking more of the earning it, you know, the pushing that boulder up the hill in terms of how much you've consumed. Apparently guilt is a big factor in hangovers. You know, that's clinically proven. That's not just some woolly theory. And if you feel like you really deserved a good night out, you're less likely to feel rough the next day.
Wow. Okay. Well, I need to start applying this then. Because I need to go, oh, actually, I needed a big night on the Raz. Whereas if you feel like you've got something to celebrate, then the next day you feel better. Okay. Well, I feel like that's a whole podcast in itself.
I think I'm as qualified to offer this kind of medical advice as you are to offer the advice you're about to engage in. So big disclaimers there from both of us, I think.
Exactly, exactly. The first section of the podcast we like to call Old Grudge. That's where we ask our guests to bring something to the table that they either wish they'd handled differently or that they're still hanging on to, something that really got under your skin and it's been around for a while. Tell me what it is.
Well, I don't think I've very seldom spoken to Emily about this. And a grudge is definitely the word, but weirdly, I think it's realising I was maybe on the other end of a grudge, is that I, as a writer, one of the things you're dealing with all the time, and especially in the early years, is coming to terms with reviews and and bad reviews. And my first few books, I got so many bad reviews. I mean, a lot of good ones, but particularly bad reviews from Scottish critics. I remember the Herald had my first novel, my first ever review I saw, absolutely slaughtered the book and said it's it was like disgustingly nasty and thoroughly unpleasant or something like that. And I actually used, the publishers used that in an ad. But I got used to getting some bad reviews. But I remember like there was I think it was published one fine day in the middle of the night, and it was getting great reviews. Then it got one bad review from one guy. And then the next novel got a bad review from the same guy. And then the novel after that also got a bad review. Then four novels in a row, this guy. And then he reviewed the paperback as well so that he could have a kick at it again. Right?
Oh, two rounds.
And I'm starting to think, well, why would you even bother reading the book if you already know you don't like this person's work? But here's where the grudge part comes in. I wrote a book called All Fun and Games Until Somebody Loses an Eye, and been told, oh, this particular Scottish newspaper is going to review it. And it was getting great reviews. It was going down really well. So I open up this Sunday paper, and there's just the most vicious hatchet job I'd ever received. And again, it's by the same critic. But here's the thing, the grudge here is not the critic. The grudge concerns the commissioning editor, whose job it is to commission the reviews. And I am, again, who will remain nameless, but I remember the reviews editor of that publication came up to me at a reception about a week later, and she was very apologetic. She said, I want you to know I had commissioned a review by someone else of this book, and this individual, who was the deputy editor of the paper, pulled rank and said, no, I'm giving the review to my choice of reviewer, and gave it to the guy who'd already written five or six hatchet jobs. And I remember just thinking, well, what purpose does it serve critically, you know, to deliberately give a book to a reviewer who you know detests a particular writer's work? Also, you know, what does it say about the reviewer that they're prepared to keep doing
that? Why do you keep hurting yourself like that?
Yeah, I mean, why? It takes, you know, it can take like 7 or 8 hours to read a book, and you're going to do that, you're going to write that. But it struck me, I thought, there's something really weird that this, this day was like the deputy editor or something like that on one of the papers pulling rank to make sure this book got a bad review. And I couldn't really work out why, you know, but I did. It's the one time I wrote to the editor of a paper and explained what had gone on, and he did apologise and say he thought it was completely unprofessional to have done this. But I kind of thought, like, every so often I think, God, that was so, when you realise you've been the subject of something that's really quite dedicatedly vicious, that, you know, to go to all that bother. And it kind of stuck with me except that I think as the years go on, you don't think so much about reviews, and the whole reviews culture has changed, and it's no longer about what's in the broadsheets, and it's about what's in the Amazon things. But what struck me latterly was that this person must have really hated me to go to that bother. And I suspect maybe I'd kind of inadvertently given him offence or something. I don't know. He commissioned.
Had you met him outside of your writing career ever?
I suspect.
I say was, he. I'm
it was. It's a safe bet. It's a safe bet. Yeah. I think back when I was when I first moved back to Edinburgh and I was working as a freelance sub editor, I would bump into this person because he worked I was doing shifts at a newspaper there, and he was he wasn't the literary editor, but he saw himself as a kind of big literary figure. And I was a humble freelance sub. And I think maybe the fact that I then, the freelance sub went on to have a literary career was maybe not what he had in mind. I think he's a bit of a gatekeeper of Scottish fiction, you know. So I don't know if that was part of it. I may have inadvertently given offence because when I can remember coming in and saying, I've got a book deal, I was all excited. And this guy liked to give the impression he knew everyone in literature. He knew all the editors. And so he said, oh, have you? Who's your editor? And I said, oh, actually, I've got two editors. And I mentioned them and he hadn't heard of either of them. And I think maybe this kind of punctured, without me meaning to, but maybe this punctured the sort of mystique he was trying to create around himself. But for whatever reason, he wrote a couple of bad reviews himself, but he kept commissioning. Any time I got a book out, he kept commissioning the same person to slag it off. And as I say, one time he actually pulled rank to make sure that the book didn't get a fair shake.
Oh, there's a lot to unpack from this. I think firstly, I think that definitely is sometimes when people get very, very angry and it seems like such a personal grudge against someone, I often think, and I've said before, that I think it's because there's a mirror there. They're seeing an aspect of something or of themselves that they... And maybe he's angry that he didn't go for it. I feel that there's definitely a struggling crime writer within this person who's like, why didn't I do that? And now this guy was beneath me and now he's overshot me. And now he's got this career and I'm furious. And I think that's ultimately, I always think that's so much sadder for him than it is for you. Because you're going to continue to, I mean, look at the success you've had. And the very book that you're talking about is behind me on the, on my wall of books. So
you'll have encountered many critics down the years. And I think actually part of it was back in the sort of early, the Steam era of the internet, I created my own website and I would put up quotes from reviews, but because it amused me, I put up quotes from the bad reviews as well as the good ones. You know, often if there was a particularly entertainingly nasty or even offended quote, and I think I put a few quotes up from some of those reviews, and I think maybe that was enough to make certain critics feel they'd been got at. Because the thing that has struck me down the years is that journalists, not all of them, you know, and not, you know, hashtag not all journalists, not all critics, but they're really thin-skinned, especially the ones who like to dole it out. I've written some quite scathing stuff about politicians down the years, and I've met a few politicians, and the thing that's always struck me about them is that they can take it. You know, they're very thick-skinned. Journalists are the most thin-skinned breed, and critics are the most thin-skinned of that breed.
Well, I think a lot of the time you are, and like we say, not all journalists, not all critics, but a lot of the time in that area, you are looking at people who had aspirations or wanted to do a thing. Then either weren't brave enough or it was unsuccessful and therefore they can get quite mad about it. And especially if it's close to where they wanted to go or they recognise some part of that, they get furious. But politicians, I find have a great sense of humour. I used to have a joke about Ed Miliband, and then I met him and I did a podcast with him, and I said, oh, I used to have a joke about you. It's quite mean. And he said to me, oh, no, go on, tell it. I said, well, the joke was, I said, you always had a look on your face like you'd just seen boobs for the first time. And he absolutely roared. He thought it was hysterical. And I was like, I really just have to have props for that and say, like, if you can take that on the chin, if you can take a bit of joking, you've got to be able to, but you can't be brittle about it, or you cannot be so scathing and mean and horrific about stuff and then say, well, obviously you can't say that about me. It's just my place to say it about other people. But I've said this before and I will say it again, any critic, and having done The Fringe so many times, I've had every review 1 to 5. You know, I got a 1-star review and then someone else apologised to me and said, sorry, that woman's a born-again Christian. So she really didn't like your abortion jokes. But I, the idea that any critic can be meaner than the voice that's in my own head, to me, is laughable. Because whatever you're going to come at me with, know that I've already done that to myself, probably since I was a teenager. So...
I remember when I first moved to Edinburgh, one of the first subbing shifts I did, it was August, so it was just reviews. You know, the Edinburgh Evening News, to its credit, just published so many reviews of what was going on at The Fringe. But because there was such a volume, you would see the kind of the sort of blue-rinsed, angry ones as well. But there was one it was when Rich Hall first did Otis Lee Crenshaw, and it was someone who hadn't realised it was a joke and or hadn't realised it was a persona. And there was an angry review who was saying how outrageous it was that, that someone who'd been incarcerated was being given this kind of platform.
Yeah, Otis Lee Crenshaw was fantastic. I love that. And I remember seeing Rich get heckled once on stage and then going, ever realise you've boxed yourself into a corner with your own character? Thank you for sharing your old grudge. It's a very good one. And I feel lots of people listening to the podcast will be able to relate to that.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
The next section of the podcast we call Topical Cream. Topical Cream, where we attempt to apply some balm to a stingy news story that's got your head up, that's got you raging. Tell me what that is.
I think you're going to need to provide a kind of whole oilatum bath here for me to step into, never mind Topical Cream, because we just had the coronation.
Yeah.
And I literally went to a cabin in the woods for the weekend, but foolishly still dipped into social media and to find out a bit about what was going on. But, you know, sort of speaking as someone who finds the whole idea of monarchy absolutely absurd, it has kind of boiled my piss over the last few days. And it's, I've got this policy on social media, and I'm sure people will be able to find out where I've not met my own standard, but I try not to slag off things that other people enjoy.
Yeah.
But this is where,
with the exception,
I've tried not to comment on the coronation. So my problem is not so much with that and with people wanting to participate. It's actually with the media narrative of this manufactured consensus rather, that we're all part of something, that we all come together and unite in this when we don't. You know, I think that's the part that really annoys me. When the Queen died, I had the good fortune to be on holiday, and but the narrative was always that the whole country was united in their somber reflection. And we were on holiday in Zante, and we had to get a room moved because there was a pub across the road that was one of these places that was full of drunk Brits every night singing karaoke. It was Sweet Caroline and Hi Ho Silver Lining, right, every night. And on the day the Queen died, Marissa, my wife, made a point of, they'd moved us to a quieter room, which we went up to the back of the hotel just to see how the sort of Union Jack Shorts Brits crowd were dealing in their somber reflection with the Queen having died. And sure enough, it was still Sweet Caroline and Hi Ho Silver Lining till 1 a.m. And that was the people who were there in Union Jack t-shirts, right? So the narrative we got was that the whole country was, you know, brought to a standstill in their grief and their reflection. And it's just simply not true.
Well, it's wild watching an entire nation collectively just lose its mind. I feel like social media amplifies that side of it as well. Because I knew, like, my mum was like, when the Queen died, she's like, she's been there my whole life since I was a little girl. So I understood the attachment and sentimentality, and through war years and everything else, what that meant to people, and to they're going to do that in whatever way they do that. Do we have to give over 5 days of television to this for 24/7. And when the presenters are desperately running out of things to say, she liked her horses. Oh, did she? I thought she hated them and probably went out and kicked them every day. Like, what are you talking about? Like, just like the absolute like dirge of commentary when there's nothing else to say.
Yeah, they're having to elevate the most banal things to a level of profundity, you know, because everything related to the royals has to seem profound and important. So yeah, they'll try and create some kind of public interest in something and of which no one has an interest. And it's like at the moment I was looking at the BBC Scotland stories on it, and they were talking about how Scotland celebrated and how Scotland's going to have all these parties. And I noticed that you start to read between the lines. For one thing, there's all these pictures and they're all taken from angles that are conspicuously taken so that they don't show just how few people are at these things. But it's to create a narrative that saying, oh, up in the Orkneys, there was a lunch, you know, and somewhere in the Borders, there was another lunch, you know. And it's, but again, you could see that the story there is actually this coronation was met largely with indifference by the majority of the population. But that's not the story we've been given.
I only heard on one, and I don't know which channel it was on. I caught bits and pieces of it, the bit where Penny Mordaunt was dressed as Serena Joy from The Handmaid's Tale, holding a ceremonial sword, which I'm waiting to see the Claire's Accessories version of the bejeweled sword coming out this summer. But I saw sort of that, and I saw, you know, that there was a horse that had like gone backwards into the crowds or something. I saw like little tiny sort of pieces of it, but in the commentary that I saw, and so I can't remember exactly which channel it was on, it said it was talking about how excited everyone was, and then they said, well, it should be noted that not everyone feels like this, because obviously there was a protester arrested just for taking signs out of a van, not even doing anything. Like, yeah, any dissidents will be dealt with swiftly and physically. And so she said it has to be noted there are counter protests. Not everyone feels this way. Like, in terms of journalistic integrity, you have to say that, you know, it's not the only mood is not jubilation that this is happening.
Yeah, but real journalistic integrity would reflect that across the medium. You know, what we get is this occasional disclaimer, like the obligation to say, oh yeah, by the way, this does not reflect the whole country. But the media narrative around the royals always has to give the impression that the whole country is united behind them. And which is not to say the whole country is Republican in its sentiment either, but also I think what it never measures is level of interest. You know, you can say here's how many people watch something, but it doesn't mean that they're particularly engaged with it.
No, some people want to see spectacles. Some people are like, this is absolutely batshit. What is happening? There's a gold carriage. There's a gold carriage. Yes. And Harry has to get in an Uber with Andy. Like, what is going on? there's parts of that where people are watching for the, and then hate watching so that you can write funny comments about it and stuff. But like, obviously the amount of money that went into it is such a huge discussion in the current climate in terms of cost of living crisis and everything else. And it's probably not for us, not the last coronation we'll see, because it will happen again. You know.
It's not going to be 70 years this time, is it?
No, it's not. It's not.
Not unless there's a vampiric quality to to Charles that we've not heard of so far.
It feels like it's not a very read the room moment.
Oh yeah, what a time for a vulgar display of ostentatious wealth.
Yeah. I do remember, and you know, bringing up Piers Morgan, but I remember when the Queen in that first austerity year did her speech, sat in front of a golden piano, and everyone was going mad about the golden piano. Piers was like, of course she has a gold, she's our monarch, she's our queen, and she reigns over us, and of course she has a gold piano, and stop being ridiculous, and she, that's part of it, you know, and how dare you. And then a week later, Kris Jenner, I hate to bring the Kardashians in, had come on Instagram with like an Hermes bag, and it had something like rich on it or something, and he was like, what a disgusting, gross, ostentatious display of wealth. And I was like, How is it okay for one person but not another? Like, you know, Chris Jenner hasn't got money out. You know, she's not a monarch. She's made it, and we can all have our opinions on how she made it. But you know, she made the money. So why is either this level of wealth is iniquity and a gross and ostentatious, or it's not? You can't just pick and choose who it's okay for, surely.
Well, I think there's a very great sort of British tradition of thinking if you have made your money, that is vulgar and you shouldn't be showing it off. But if you've inherited your money, you should show it off. Absolutely. and Kris Jenner has fallen on the wrong side of that one, obviously.
Yes, yeah, she's nouveau riche.
Yeah, yeah. It's like there was that line in Succession in the previous series where Harriet Walter's character says witheringly of someone, yes, he bought his own furniture.
Well, I have some inherited furniture, but I don't necessarily think that means that it's expensive inherited furniture.
Yes, it's not a Chippendales.
Yeah. It's one of those things where I guess another point to this is the inescapability of it. Mm. Like, you've had to go to a cabin in the woods. Mm. And when I turned up at my show last night, the tech was like, I wore all black yesterday. if you don't want to participate in that, and I can imagine that I don't think there was any street parties near me, but I can imagine that people had some fun street parties, and if people want to get together and have a party and be a community and do neighborhood things and that, I think that's all fine, you know. But it felt like, if no matter what channel you turn to, this was going to be shown, and you know, I don't think you had a choice if you stayed engage with it.
No, I mean, obviously, it was something they were trying to celebrate. I think when it was the Queen's funeral and the mourning period, that sense that you were being addressed as though you were part of this, that we are all mourning, and it wasn't really the case for most of us. I mean, people could respectfully mourn the loss of a monarch and acknowledge the contribution they felt that this monarch had made, but what really got my nerves was the people who were talking about, oh, she was like your gran or whatever. So what, if your gran was a woman you'd never met? You know? if your gran was emotionally remote.
I also had a very distant grandmother. Yeah. I have a Scottish grandmother. So in some ways, yes.
Geographically distant.
Yeah. Oh, she was wonderful. Thank you for sharing. I can very much get on board with your topical gripe there. Now, it's time for what we call an unpopular opinion. This is where we asked our guests to tell us something they love that they know everyone else hates, or vice versa. Just what is it?
In keeping with trying, I realise this show is all about gripes, so I thought I want to say something positive.
Okay.
So my unpopular opinion is a movie I love that I can't make a critical case for, and everyone perhaps rightly disdains it, and that movie is Velvet Goldmine.
But is that Jonathan Rhys-Meyers?
Yes. It's a movie about glam rock, the glam rock era, and it came out in about 97, I think. It was the opening film at the Edinburgh Film Festival. They had a big themed party, and then I remember just it got slaughtered by the critics and lots of people hated it. And I think one of the reasons they hated it was people were thinking it was going to be a kind of Bowie biopic analogue, you know, in which Jonathan Rhys-Meyers' character was essentially David Bowie. And he is, in lots of ways. He's inspired by Bowie, and Ewan McGregor's character is inspired by Iggy Pop. And I think there was that, you know, that kind of fandom protectiveness. It was like, we wanted a Bowie movie, we didn't get it, so we're not going to actually address what this film's really about. We're just going to be angry that it's not a Bowie biopic. And also that preciousness around certain stars that the fans just they wouldn't have been happy with a Bowie biopic anyway. But it's a film that I really love it because what it's about isn't about being a pop star. It's not about glam rock. It's about being a fan. Because really at the heart of the film is Christian Bale plays this journalist. And he's a journalist later in the film, but it's about how he's a gay teenager who feels finally a sense of identity and joy and celebration in glam rock when it comes along. And in the character of Brian Slade, as he's called, is the kind of the Bowie figure in this. And there's this wonderful moment where he's lives in Manchester in some really kind of dingy sort of back street, and is with the really kind of parents who are always in front of the TV, and Brian Slade is on TV on Top of the Pops and being outrageous, and he's like pointing to the telly and pointing to his parents and saying, "Look, Mom, that's me. And it's this feeling every kid has had at one point, to say that here's the thing I aspire towards, or here's something that means a lot to my identity, and there it is. And it captures that absolutely brilliantly. But also, I think people hated it as well because of this sort of pseudo Bowie figure and the music and the way they depict his image. They have a version of Ziggy Stardust, which is that he has this character called Maxwell Demon. So he plays a kind of alien turned rock star. And what I think people didn't realize is that you can't put what Bowie did back then in a movie in the 90s and expect people to feel that the impact that it would have. So what Todd yes. Haynes did something else, something very strange. So the strangeness of it hits you and you think, my God, what must that have been like? Because this feels weird to me now. But if it's something that you've seen videos of for 20, 25 years, it's not going to have any impact on you. So I think, it's a highly flawed film. Its timeline is all over the place. And it's got some laughably pretentious dialogue which might even have been intentional, because I think the characters every so often try to be profound about their music and they just sound like arseholes. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, I think it's a bit of a curate's egg, but I do love the fact that it's about music, it's about loving music, about how music means so much to you when you are a certain age, and how it helps shape your identity, but also ultimately about how it's all a big fraud, because the Brian Slade character morphs into this kind of American 80s Reaganite stadium band act. And that happens to, you know, every idealistic teenager grows up and finds that the bands they loved have become old. So it's about a lot of things I can relate to, but I totally understand why people thought it was shit.
I was just looking up some quotes. So yes, directed by Todd Haynes, Brian Slade quote, "I knew I should create a sensation," gasped the Rocket, and out he went. Oh, no, this is quoting Oscar Wilde.
Oh, yeah, there's a lot of Oscar Wilde quotes in the film. Yeah.
"Mandy Slade, you all know me. Subtlety's my middle name. It's as subtle as the piece of skin between my vagina and anus. Ooh la la, what's that called? I can never quite remember. No Man's Land. Oh, gosh, my geez, darling."
Yeah, that's...
Who plays Mandy Slade?
Toni Collette.
Toni Collette. That's it, right.
I mean, she's having a ball. I mean, everyone in the film is having a great time making the film.
Yeah, I've only ever seen pieces of it, so I could neither make the case for or against. The pieces that I saw looked intriguing, and the cast is pretty stellar.
Mm.
Think, in the light, maybe in that you could make a case for it, in the light of all the current crop of biopics, because there have been a sort of rash of them in the last 5 yeah. years, maybe, even, just with the, you know, the Elvis one, the Queen one, the Elton
Rocket
John
Man.
One.
Yeah.
You know, we've gone through a few of the, especially of the 70s, of that period.
It's definitely not better than any of those films, by the way. But it's just that I get what it was trying to do, and it has got some wonderful moments.
But those are actual biopics, so you can kind of go, look, we've got all of those. This is just like a reimagining of a time. In a similar way that Almost Famous is not about, you know, Fleetwood Mac or the Eagles or... Yeah. Credence, which was maybe it's closest to Credence.
The Allman Brothers, wasn't it? The Allman,
Allman
Brothers.
Brothers it? Yeah. Yes, yeah. I got one more silver dollar. But yeah. So that you kind of, it can create its own thing. I think it's hard. I think everyone has an opinion when you know, that they want it to be, you know, yeah. Like you say, it was never going to make those people happy because they wanted a Bowie biopic. But even if they'd have got one, they wouldn't have liked what they got because it wouldn't have been their version of him.
Yeah, there is always that kind of gatekeeping element that certain fans will never be happy. Someone said recently that the worst thing about any cultural element is its fandom. And so I suppose it helped for me. It's not that I wasn't a Bowie fan. It's just that I wasn't, you know, a religious Bowie fan. So I didn't feel like there was a... I was approaching Bohemian Rhapsody with a degree of trepidation because I was a big Queen fan and I knew so much about Freddie Mercury and his life. So the liberties they were taking with it were obviously going to grate a bit more, but I could see why they took the decisions that they did to create a more satisfying narrative. In Velvet Goldmine, there isn't really a satisfying narrative because it's so all over the place. Well, there is and there isn't. I mean, ultimately, there's huge elements of it that totally work and other elements that are complete trash fire. especially when it is trying to be profound, but it gets... One of the things it gets is how quickly in a culture or in a scene it's there and it's gone. You know, they have a kind of farewell to glam concert, and it's only meant to be about 3 years after glam started, because that is always the case. You partly that if you don't appreciate a cultural moment, it's gone. But also, one thing I've noticed in every culture is that someone's always going to tell you just missed the golden age. You know, whenever you turn up, someone's going to say, "Oh, it's all over now. This was all at its peak." You know, 18 months ago or 6 months ago, you know. It's like, actually, you mentioned Almost Famous, that there's the great moment in that with Philip Seymour Hoffman playing Lester Bangs, and he says to the young critic, "Oh, you're going to be a music reviewer. That's great. Too bad you missed rock and roll."
I love that. Thank you for bringing that. It's almost like that could be an unpopular opinion / guilty pleasure.
Yeah, yeah. Oh no, I've got much guilty pleasures. But see, I can at least make an aesthetic case for Velvet Goldmine.
This is the section of the podcast we call Historical Beef. That's where we look at a rivalry, a historical one. And I thought we might do a literary one. And then Chris, you said to me, actually, I'd quite like to cover a rock and roll beef. So tell me what you want to talk about.
Yeah, you know, in way, way before the era of rap battles and diss tracks, there was this kind of back and forth beef, which started with Neil Young writing his song Southern Man, and then the song Alabama. And it was Southern Man was about the Ku Klux Klan and racism and Jim Crow in the South. And it seemed to greatly upset Lynyrd Skynyrd, who were from Alabama, and Ray Van Zant, the songwriter, who had been a big Neil Young fan and would perform in Neil Young t-shirts, and they massively took the huff. And
so that's such a Scottish phrase, by the way. I've loved hearing today. Yeah.
About Alabama being dissed this way. So they wrote Sweet Home Alabama, which is a fantastic track. And it's got a line in it about, I hope Neil Young remembers that South don't need him anyway. You know, Southern Man don't need him anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
I can kind of relate to that, or not relate to it from that perspective. I've seen it so many times. People can't take criticism of like where they're from. It's like they only want to celebrate. They can't take the rough with the smooth. But they wrote that song as their response. And then... Shortly after the band died, Warren Zevon wrote his own response, which is a song called Play It All Night Long. And it goes, Grandpa pissed his pants again, he don't give a damn. Brother Billy got both guns drawn, he ain't been right since Vietnam. Sweet Home Alabama, play that dead band song. And it's this horrible, horrible song about incest and farmyard diseases and everything's falling apart, but we'll ignore all the things that are wrong in Alabama and we'll all sing that dead band song. We're all singing Sweet Home Alabama all night. So this was his way of saying these things are still wrong with Alabama, and no matter how good a song Sweet Home Alabama is, it hasn't addressed any of the issues there of racism and domestic violence and all the things that Neil Young was alluding to. And I love the fact that... there was this way of expressing it through music, that Lynyrd Skynyrd's way of expressing their kind of state pride was to do so in this song. And to be fair, Neil Young later did apologise. He felt he'd been, as a kind of liberal Canadian, he maybe wasn't in the best place to write about another area. So he did write and work with, or I think he wrote to Lynyrd Skynyrd hoping they would work together, but I think the plane crash happened before they could.
That pops up in Con Air, the plane crash.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's a beautiful, like, kind of a bunch of, like, you know, prisoners in a plane singing a song about a bunch of musicians that died in a plane crash.
Yeah, that sounds... Yeah. Steve Buscemi points it out. It's just divine irony. A bunch of idiots on a plane dancing to a song by a band that died in a plane crash.
Yes, yeah. But a lot of Lynyrd Skynyrd's song... Have you ever heard God and Guns?
I think so. I'm not. Yeah, couldn't quote the lyrics.
The peacemaker in the dresser drawer, God and Guns is what keeps us strong. So, you know, they're certainly putting a viewpoint out. And I think it's okay for someone else to come out and go, not sure I quite agree with that. Yes. And it's, but it's the same. It's always the same argument that somehow if you're critical of something that you can't also accept that there's brilliant things from it. So I felt this extended to, I don't want to make everything about Brexit, but, you know, there was this kind of like buy British campaign, I suppose, in the you know, post Brexit, to which it was sort of being pushed by the government. I was like, oh, it's interesting, isn't it? Because the only thing we appear to be manufacturing from this government is mass incompetence. And then I had people just kind of going, you hate Britain. You hate, how dare you? You are, one person said I was treasonous for saying it. And I was like, well, I am British. So if I hate Britain, then I hate myself. Like, what are you talking about? Mm. I can be incredibly proud of what we've done. I can be proud of the NHS. I can be proud of sporting. I can be proud of so many, you know, education, you know, that, well, I mean, that's changing as well. It never used to cost as much, you know, like in America, the system that they have there. But you can, of course, you can still like be from a place and be proud of lots of things about it, but also be critical. And it just sort of seems that people don't accept that you can hold, you know, multitudes
It's a conservative trope often to say, if you're critical of your country, you're being unpatriotic.
Yeah,
and I think actually it speaks to a lack of security and insecurity about people's identity if they can't take criticism. I think Brexit was the ultimate expression of that, in that people who purported to be hugely patriotic Brits, the reason they were voting for Brexit was, or they were advocating Brexit, was they didn't have as high an opinion of Britain, or weren't feeling as secure in Britain's identity as the French were as of France, or as Germans were of Germany. Because the Germans didn't feel that being part of the EU was diluting their sense of national identity. They had enough of a robust sense of their identity to not feel that way, whereas certain British people felt insecure about their identity and felt we have to stand alone. And you encounter this all the time. It's why I think with them, I often thought that why Warren Zevon wrote that report, he'll have encountered this as well. People who, the minute there's any criticism of something they hold dear, that instead of saying, well, can I take that criticism? You know, can I take the rough with the smooth? Is this anything you do love, you have to be able to see its flaws. And sometimes we love something because of their flaws, whereas just deflecting criticism as a gut reaction just shows that you aren't as robust in your love of that thing as you'd like to profess.
Yes. And it was interesting, actually, because Brexit brought up so much of this. And I tried not to, because I think I sort of tried to understand why people voted to leave. And then, you know, in the aftermath of it, we saw a lot of people voted because they were promised things that they didn't get. So everyone knows what that feels like. Mm. or that they were lied to. I mean, Scotland, you know, yeah. I mean, have every right to be raging and demanding when they're going to get to ask about independence again, because, you know, there are a lot of Scottish people who voted, you know, in the referendum to stay in the UK because we were going to be part of the EU.
Yeah, yeah, that was one of the major arguments was often made. If you vote for independence, you'll be voting yourself out of the EU. Yeah, that went down well.
Yeah. But I wonder if, you know, to close the circle slightly on the song front, I do think that whenever I look into these rivalries in the creative arenas, that actually they help, I guess, elevate all the art is the hope. Mm-hmm. Is that one person inspiring another means someone's been inspired, whether it's through anger or love or joy or disdain, to respond to something that then it just begets more art.
Yes, I think also you would have to I guess every songwriter will say sometimes they come up with a song that's middling, you know, that not everyone knocks out of the park. But if you're going to write a song that's a riposte to someone, you're not going to release it unless you know it's an absolute belter, because the first comeback is, well, their song was better than yours.
Yeah.
So it not only creates more art, but it forces you to raise your own bar. You know, if you're going to write something that's a reaction, yours better be as good as theirs.
It's been amazing having you on the podcast. Before we sign off, is there anything you'd like to plug?
Oh,
because
yeah.
You've got publishing dates and all sorts. So tell us where people can find you and what to look out for.
My paperback of my latest book, The Cliff House, is out on May 25th. And the new Ambrose Parry novel, which the books I write with my wife, the historical novel, that's called Voices of the Dead. That'll be out on June 15th. But lots of festivals going to over the summer. We'll be at the I Write Festival in Glasgow on May 19th with the Fun Loving Crime Writers.
Oh, yes, that's your band with Val McDermid and
Mark Billingham, Stuart Neville, Doug Johnson and Luca Vesti. And the band will also be appearing at the Borders Book Festival in Melrose in June. And I think we're also appearing at the Harrogate Crime Festival in July. So, yeah, we're looking forward to a great summer of literary events and rock and roll.
Brilliant. I like it. Multitasking. Yes, I got a copy of the book and it's fantastic. So get your hands on that when it comes out on May 25th. You won't regret it, I promise. And also Christopher is on various social medias, I believe. I don't know how frequently, but you can also seek him out there. And are you at the Edinburgh Festival?
Yeah, I'll be. Marissa and I, as Ambrose Parry, will be at the Edinburgh Book Festival.
Right, okay, at the book festival. Fantastic. And I'm there for a week, actually, doing a work in progress at the Monkey Barrel. So that's the first time I've announced that. So you've heard it here on the podcast. Just a week, 14th to the 20th. I am also on tour right now across the UK. If you're about and you want to see me, check out my website. All the details are on there. On my Instagram, Tiff Stevenson Comic, Twitter, all the usual places. Thank you so much, Christopher Brookmeyer. It has been fantastic having you on the podcast.
It has been cathartic.
You can listen to other programs from The Bugle, including The Bugle, Catharsis, Tiny Revolutions, Top Stories, and The Gargle, wherever you find your podcasts.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.